decision needs to be taken based on the situation on the ground, considering the freely expressed will of the Ossetian and Abkhaz people and being guided by the provisions of the UN Charter, the 1970 Declaration on the Principles of International Law Governing Friendly Relations Between States, the CSCE Helsinki Final Act of 1975, and other fundamental international instruments, I signed decrees on the recognition by the Russian Federation of South Ossetia's and Abkhazia's independence. Russia calls on other states to follow its example. This is not an easy choice to make, but it represents the only possibility to save human lives. In a speech he addressed to the Russian people on August 26th, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev decried a nighttime execution-style bombardment by Georgian troops in a part of Georgia known as South Ossetia, a bombardment that killed hundreds of civilians, including, according to Medvedev, Russian peacekeepers who gave their lives in fulfilling their duty to protect women, children, and the elderly. What situation in the former Soviet Republic led to military conflict with Russia? And what's likely to happen next? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
If Russia breaks South Ossetia and Abkhazia away from Georgia by recognizing their independence, what sort of precedent will it set for Russia's power over the other former Soviet republics? Is this a step toward reassembling the Soviet Union? Who's controlling Russia and its foreign policy? And what, if anything, should the United States do about the conflict between Russia and Georgia? Our guest is David McDonald, the chairman of the History Department at the UW-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Anytime Russia's in the news, I'm made aware of the fact that I really don't know what's going on there sort of politically. And, you know, the sort of former USSR, I think most of us are still trying to figure out what is the relationship between Russia and these other parts that used to be together with it. Who's running Russia? What is the president versus the prime minister doing? Can you sort of give us the basics right now and what's going on in terms of just structurally in Russia?
Oh, it's an interesting question, especially since it's 18 years right about now that the Soviet Union really began its final stages of dissolution. But what can I tell you? That the Russian Federation is a republican polity. It's comprised of a series of different types of legislative subjects, sub-jurisdictions, states, independent districts and the like, some regionally defined, some ethnically defined. It is governed out of Moscow by an executive headed by the president, whose nominees for various cabinet-level positions have to be vetted and approved by the elective Duma, the state Duma, which is elected by, to us, a very complicated system of proportional representation, a system, I should add, that is designed to exclude smaller parties from ultimate representation. The state Duma is the lower house, and then there's a Council of the Federation, which would correspond to the Senate in this country. But the party with the largest number of deputies in the Duma will be the party that forms a cabinet headed by a prime minister, which is in charge of a great deal of the domestic governance of the country in cooperation with the presidency. And as we know, the current president is Dmitry Medvedev, a longtime protege but relatively inexperienced administrator from the inner circles of the former president and now the prime minister, Vladimir Putin. Both are from St. Petersburg, the erstwhile Leningrad. Both have a background that takes them to the Faculty of Law at St. Petersburg State University. Medvedev was more or less anointed the successor at the turn of the year by Putin. There had been a great deal of guessing about whether or not Putin would violate his constitution and seek an unmandated or an unconstitutional third term as president. He did the ultimate finesse and simply, knowing his popularity, had installed himself at the head of a party called Unified Russia, the majority party in the Duma, and became prime minister. The division of powers between the two is very unclear, as most of your listeners will have known from the commentary surrounding the recent events in Georgia. Now, formally, after the Soviet Union broke up, one of the fig leaves to try and preserve some sort of, I guess, geopolitical stature in that part of the world was the creation of something called the Community of Independent States. which was largely a loose confederation. I think people originally, the creators of it, some saw it as a way of trying to hold on to what remained of the Soviet Union. Others saw it as the possibility of creating in the old Russian imperial sphere or the Soviet sphere something like the EU was becoming in Europe.
A trade zone.
A trade zone, an interest in shared security. For instance, the Russian Federation still maintains military bases in quite a few of these former Soviet republics. The Baltic states were never in it. Others were, including Ukraine, Belarus, the stands, as we call them now, the Central Asian republics. Georgia, in August, in response to the Russian incursion into the Georgian Republic following the events in Skhinvali in Ossetia on August 7th and 8th, Georgia announced its withdrawal from the Commonwealth or the Association of Independent States. Beyond that, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania all belong to NATO, all have status in the EU, and I think are regarded as untouchable by the Russian Federation and policymakers and military strategists. But you have ongoing difficult relations with Ukraine, which was the site of the so-called Orange Revolution in 2004, where what appeared to have been a fixed election, which seemed to install pro-Russian president, was undone by street protests, by a huge rally in Independence Place in Kyiv, leading to the elevation of the current incumbent as president, Viktor Yushchenko. There are also tensions with Kyrgyzstan, the home of the so-called Violet Revolution. We have all these colored revolutions.
Yes.
Georgia saw the Rose Revolution, just like Lebanon had their own, I'm trying to think, Cedar Revolution, I believe it was.
Yes.
So it's, on a certain level, sort of astounding that we're 18 years out from the collapse of the Communist Party-directed Soviet Union, and we are still dealing with its shadow or its detritus, its vestiges, and that these are still matters of active political engagement, both in the individual republics themselves, but within the Russian Federation as well.
And Chechnya would fall in the category of what, a turmoil within one of the former republics?
Chechnya was really, it's on the border between, or it's in the interstice between the Russian Federation and the Georgian Republic, and really close to Azerbaijan. If your listeners could look at a map, they would see the Caucasus Mountains running between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. They'd see Azerbaijan and Georgia. Chechnya is just to the north of that, but also borders on Dagestan and Ingushetia and the territories we're looking at now. Chechnya was maybe an attempt at self-determination and separation, maybe one of the fronts in the Islamist campaign against secularization or whatever it is that they feel the need to engage in terror against. Chechnya was a very complicated thing and a very messy thing that seems to be quiet right now. But that was, in some ways, your listeners should also know that this whole area has been very volatile for the two-plus centuries that Russians or anybody else has tried to control them.
And how much of this is ethnic? In other words, if you look at something like what's going on in Georgia right now, to what extent is it partly an identity of ethnic Georgians, ethnic Russians? What is the difference?
I think it's less ethnic Russians and ethnic Georgians, although there are tensions that go back to Soviet days, but there have been a few press accounts recently, including, I believe it was in the New York Times of Sunday, September 7th, reminding readers that actually there has been a lot of contact over 250 years between Georgians and Russians. There are many ethnic Georgians living in Russia, many ethnic Russians living in Tbilisi, a beautiful city, the capital of the Georgian Republic. But that ethnic factor is not large, at least from the Russian side. The Russians don't see this as an ethnic, or the Russian government does not see this as an ethnic conflict. They might see it as a geopolitical conflict or a neat way to cut through a whole bunch of knots that have been tied up since the early 90s. But Georgians, from what I can tell, ethnic Georgians and ethnic Ossetians and natives of Abkhazia, there are strongly held rivalries among these groups, some of which were exacerbated during the Stalinist era, some of which have become exacerbated since 1991. For instance, a Georgian president named Gamsa Khurdia, one of the first presidents of the successor states, the states that broke away from the Soviet Union, undertook what one might consider an ethnically assertive policy with regards to Ossetia. The Russian government claims that the Georgian forces that bombarded and invaded Skhinvali on August 7th, August 8th, were involved in a process of ethnic cleansing. The Georgians now claim the opposite in various international bodies. There is a longstanding... tradition is too strong a word, but there are longstanding stories and practices of interethnic tension between Ossetians on the ground and Georgians, especially in this province of South Ossetia.
So how is this likely to get viewed by the United States if we look at this 1991 incident that Medvedev refers to in the same speech cited at the beginning of the hour, where he's talking about, as you've mentioned, David, the bombardment, which was an attempt at a kind of a blitzkrieg. How does the United States view all of this? So much of it sounds like the old Soviet rhetoric on the one hand, but who's to know?
Well, what's interesting this time out is how transparent the rhetoric is, that we're not hearing it masked in uniting people behind the progressive cause of the spread of socialism, that if you went after breakaway territories, they were sliding into retrograde practices or they were being sabotaged by anti-Soviet forces or imperialist forces. Although we do hear echoes of the old rhetoric in the charge, for instance, that at least from what I saw, the Financial Times was able to confirm that the United States military had advisors on the ground in Georgia. They were training the Georgian equivalent of the Navy SEALs, what Russians call the Spetsnaz, special assignment troops. And certainly the Russian government feels that a lot of these revolutions, the Orange Revolution, the Violet Revolution in Kyrgyzstan, and the Rose Revolution in Georgia, benefited from the influx of money and advice from the United States and other NATO powers. So you get some of that ideological overtone to the rhetoric. But I think what's striking now is that they express themselves in clear geopolitical terms.
Good old-fashioned nationalism?
Not even that. For instance, Medvedev says, we believe that places like Georgia are one of those special spheres of interest that we have, and we have them all over the world, and people have to recognize them. Now, David Miliband, the British Foreign Secretary, in an interview last week that I heard, responded to this by saying, well, spheres of interest, great powers don't talk like this anymore. This goes back to the age of empires and the like. And yet, in fairness to the Russians, what do you say when you see, for instance, Kosovo detached from Serbia, which had sovereign authority over it, whatever the wishes of the domestic population, without consulting Russia, one of Serbia's allies? They more or less, from the Muscovite point of view, unilaterally detach Kosovo and invest it with sovereignty and using all the trappings. That's why in that opening quotation, you hear Medvedev walk so carefully through the OSCE, the UN mandates, all the various international legal apparatus. He's establishing an equivalency there. Or when in the Czech Republic or Poland, NATO establishes, or the United States government, having abrogated the anti-ballistic missiles, unilaterally abrogated the anti-ballistic missile agreement that goes back to Nixon and Brezhnev, ancient history. Now they're planning to put in these batteries, high-quality ordnance, that are supposedly aimed against Iran. So from that point of view, this is geopolitical, and they're simply saying, we cannot put up with the installation of hostile regimes under our backside without being consulted.
And how much is Putin calling the shots, and what difference does it make? It's, you know, from an outsider point of view, he's kind of hard to read. He has always that sort of – I know that I think George Bush said he looked in his eyes and could see his soul or something like that. But, you know, to what extent is this the Putin era and what happens on the ground dependent on that?
It is remarkably and pervasively the Putin era in Russia. A colleague of mine on the UW campus, Ted Gerber in sociology, he and another sociologist have been doing these polls, sort of measuring attitudes and inclinations and political orientation on the part of what they call the Putin generation. Russians, I think it's from the age of like 18 to 40. And it is remarkable the strength and breadth of support for Putin and for his policies, for this reassertion of a serious, dynamic, quote-unquote, great Russia. I think Putin deserves some credit. He is certainly the articulator and the channel for it. But I also think that he is made possible by a whole variety of circumstances, not least of which is a very powerful coalition that he's been able to hammer together of representatives of the military, certain economic sectors, which he has established very close relations with just through putting his appointees on boards of directors or making them quasi-state operations, and a great many people whom we might think of as liberals or rule of law liberals who feel that it's even as important to have a dynamic and a respected Russia as it is to have rule of law right now. He's managed to put together this large coalition, some visible, some not so visible. Let's not forget the security forces. And I think he, as I said, articulates something that they all feel and something that many Russians feel is the necessity for a great Russia. Now, where is it? Where is it Putin? The bluntness, the calculatedness. There was a commentator in the Times of London who turned the reprisals against the Georgian attack and the reprisals including the invasion, the trashing of Gori, Stalin's birthplace, among other things. He said the two points he made in the column that I found just fascinating, a guy named Michael Binion. One was that Russians play chess, and we should not forget that.
Strategists.
That this is, and chess is a long-term game. You're thinking several moves down the road. We don't. And I hope we get back to that because I think that's a real problem. But Binion also qualified or characterized this coup, this démarche or this invasion as brutal and brilliant, right? That Putin, and I have no doubt that he was the person who spearheaded the decision-making and set up the scenario, Georgia was isolated. Georgia, the Georgian government apparently didn't realize how isolated it was, but there was nothing anybody could do. And you could make the point, and I think they successfully calculated that Western response would be – that Western – by Western, I mean American, EU, and NATO, three different types of bodies, that there would be obviously a harsh and negative reaction. But in real terms – and this is another turn of speech that Medvedev espoused in his statement – that in the way it is on the ground, Russia would get – to dictate the situation. And so what do we see? We see them go in, invade, remind everybody as much as they can that they weren't the aggressors. It was the Georgians were the aggressors. And then since then, they've effected a strategic set of retreats. They made the agreement, right, the Sarkozy-Medvedev agreement to retreat. They've read it in a certain way and listened to us and the three Western bodies complain about non-observance. And then they'll go back one step, always clearly, at least in terms of their self-representation to their population, at their initiative and not in response to our behest.
True.
I think it's true. Yeah, I think the Russian dealing with Georgia was a warning that you cannot fool around in our backyard without getting us in on the game, that we have critical strategic interests. What is it Medvedev says? We will not be lectured like schoolchildren anymore.
We're going to look at the past of Russia and how that's influencing what's happening right now on the ground when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest David MacDonald, who is going to give us more insight into what is going on in Russia today, something that we need to be updated on from time to time, but most particularly in light of the recent developments between Russia and Georgia. Just a minute ago, David, you said that the Russians have indicated that they're not to be spoken to like children anymore. When did we speak to them like children, and what's the difference today?
Well, we've spoken, I think from their point of view, we've spoken to them like children since 1991, right? Collapse of Soviet authority, the emergence of the Yeltsin government, all the pain and the turmoil and the maelstrom that was associated with that, right? Crash privatization, the whole constitutional showdown in 1993, the attempt to create a private market, a free trade economy. Well, we always thought, and I think we told ourselves during the Cold War, I think we tell ourselves the same thing with regard to China, that, okay, the whole struggle of the Cold War was about our system, free enterprise, constitutional liberties, what, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the whole great story of liberal Western constitutional democracy. It was a fight between that and a silly, irrational, outmoded, absolutist sort of brontosaurus or stegosaurus, right, with the walnut-sized
more
brain
prickly.
And the pelvis, yeah, that was historically outmoded and only held itself together through the application of brute force and tyrannization of its population. And that history told us that when you got free markets into places, they all of a sudden started looking like us, right? And so once the socialist order collapsed, or the state socialist or the communist order collapsed, I think a lot of people believed with Francis Fukuyama that we'd reached the end of history, that there were no more meaningful ideological, philosophical system types of struggles. Now we might differ over tariffs. It might be like Canada and the United States with the free trade agreement and negotiating hardwood or cedar shingles, but nothing that would be sort of the systemic conflict.
It's ideological.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing we did was we looked at the world through our own eyes and through the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. And so, okay, the Russians, the Communist Party system didn't work, so they would automatically see that it's our system that works, right? So on one level, we've been telling them this is how you build a capitalist economy and a constitutional order, having lost total sight of the fact that even in our societies, right, from the Magna Carta, which is what, 1215, to the Voter Rights Acts of the mid-60s, which finally extended and guaranteed the franchise to American citizens of color, that's 750 years, with not a little conflict in between. This was not something that sprang fully formed out of the forehead of the signatories of Magna Carta.
And we're expecting them to pull it off in three
and
or
we're
four.
Saying, well, and not only this is how you're going to do it, but you're going to use the same state power that was so abusive during the communist period, you're going to use that power to construct underneath you a society of laws and property and the rest of it. But now on top of that, we acted – so we told them how to do this. We gave them IMF money and all the rest of it. We told them to take it easy when their economy crashed in the late 90s. But at the same time, we acted like they were no longer a factor in international affairs, that they'd had it. They were spent force. We might welcome them back to the table. And so what happened in the meantime was NATO, for better or worse, dictated solutions to the disintegration of the old Yugoslav state, the question of Serbia and the intervention in Serbia in the late 90s, right at the time when the Russians were prostrate, the inclusion in NATO of the Czech Republic, Poland, the Baltic Republics, and that. All of these, look, I'm a citizen of the West. I think it was a great thing to guarantee those states their security. But even the invasion of Iraq, issues like that, if you listen to Russians, there was no consultation. Russians, we should remember, like a lot of societies, there's a great deal of, how can you put it, historical memory. Russians are patriotic too. They take great pride in their cultural legacy. They take great pride in having been a very important state for much of the last three centuries. And on the popular level, when Putin said at one point the collapse of the Soviet Union was the geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, many, many Russians agreed with him. Not because it just meant that they had to get a visa to go see relatives in Ukraine or in Georgia, places they'd gone to as a matter of course in the old days, but also because they felt that their country was being treated with disrespect. So one thing that – and you already saw it starting to happen in the late – very late last years of the 20th century, about the time that Putin was starting to – was coming to power – you started to see Russia pushing back. You started to see Russia, if you're going to include people in NATO, at least we need a body that will include us as well.
The Russians saying that they want to be included in a body similar to NATO.
Yes, yes. And it's suspended right now. But there was a Russian representative at NATO. There was a thing called the NATO-Russian Council that talked about matters of common interest and the like. But on a great many matters, particularly those concerning the Balkans and what they would call the near abroad, the states surrounding them, Russians felt like their opinion was not being taken duly into consideration. And we acted like they were never going to return.
Well, we didn't know about that oil, for one thing.
Well, and that was the big thing, obviously, that happened, is the oil price rise, which, you know, you don't have to be Al Gore to see our role in contributing to the spiking of oil prices, along with China and India coming online, emulating our patterns of consumption and thereby increasing demand for carbon-based or petroleum-based, oil-based fuel.
And how much oil does Russia actually have and where is the money from it going?
That's a good question. Reserves are always notoriously unreliable, but Russia has huge reserves, not just oil but liquid of natural gas. Europe relies on Russia for a very large amount of its imports for petroleum. The money is going into different sources. It was going into the pockets of a bunch of gentlemen who we refer to as the oligarchs, but over the last 5 to 7 years, the Putin administration, and well, the work was done by the time he'd stepped down, has either sequestered and taken over a great deal, many of these assets, or has so colonized their boards of directors that they're outgrowths of state power and they respond to state policy. So Gazprom, the big energy complex, is really a creature of the Russian state.
So he's nationalizing the oil industry.
Well, not quite nationalizing, because you let them trade. What they've done is, I think what they want is a situation in which, and here's the nub, right, for us. Places like Russia or China demonstrate at least the possibility of having what we would call authoritarian or dirigist or centralized state governments that are much more interventionist than ours, which we always try to put behind constitutional hedges. We've always said that that type of government is incompatible with capitalism, with commercial development, with market economies. These guys, I think, proceeding out of a perspective that goes back to the 17th century in Central Europe and the creation of what we call absolutism, these people feel that you can harness the operations of the free market and the undeniable benefits it provides, right? They don't want to be producing toothbrushes and shoes and soap like the old Soviet economy did. That it's not worth their while. There are smaller private concerns that can do it better. People get money. The consumer's happy because she's getting what she wants. And the bigger ones, the heavy industry or strategic sectors, there are ways you can let them participate in world economy using the instruments of high finance and of asset exchange to get involved with and maximize their profits. You can harness those to increase your power doubly, the revenues that come from it on one side, plus the leverage that you acquire in an oil-strapped international economy that has political consequences on the other. So what's fascinating in this instance is that Putin has managed to overcome something that trammeled his Soviet predecessors. He's recognized that you can harness economic might to the promotion of the state, to the promotion of Russian greatness, and in doing that, to increase popular support. Because the other thing we forget is when we talk about absolutism, and it springs out of stories that Americans tell themselves about the origins of their revolution and republic, or speaking more broadly, what Winston Churchill would have called the English-speaking peoples, what we tell all of ourselves about how we got constitutions and they were a good thing. We often characterize absolutism as rigid, as I said, saurian, like dinosaurs. They're the Persians to our Greeks. Right.
Yeah.
They're the empire to our federation. They are the Mordor to our Gondor or Shire or whatever you have. You know, that there are these very venerable myths that go back, well, in some ways to Greece, but to really their reinvention by late 18th and early 19th century English public schoolboys and masters about what the nature is of this conflict. We inherited them. But we, in doing so, we forget that proponents of absolutism also want popular support.
Yes, right. So it makes life easier for them.
And it invigorates the quality of the state. Let me read a quote, because I think it's critical, of how Putin squares what we would consider a circle. Like, how can you have a popular authoritarian state, right? and a popularly democratically supported authoritarian state. This is from a speech that Putin read just before he assumed the presidency from Boris Yeltsin at the end of 1999. It was really his self-introduction to the citizens of the Russian Federation. And it was a long speech, very reflective. What people like about Putin is the Russian word is seriozny. He's serious, but in a sense, he's respectable. He didn't look – he wasn't like a buffoon the way we understood Yeltsin to
right.
be. This guy, he's very trenchant, serious. Yeah, he takes great pride in being a teetotaler. His judo, he's very fit, right? There was a recent – last summer, there was sort of a beefcake
yes.
shot of Vladimir Putin out, I don't know,
fishing.
Wrestling bears or something. Yeah.
He's very controlled.
Yeah,
he always seems in control.
Always in control. And he was talking – to the Russian population, I think it's December 30th, 1999, and sort of laying out his understanding of what it was the Russian people wanted and what was going on in Russia. And he says, I want your listeners to listen to the language he uses because he has a much more textured way of understanding and depicting the state and its relation to popular opinion or public opinion than I think our way of looking at that state is usually able to accommodate. And, let me quote. Here, he says, in Russia, the state, its institutions and structures always played an exceptionally important role in the life of the country and the people. For a Russian, a strong state is not an anomaly, not something with which to struggle, but, to the contrary, the source and guarantor of order, the initiator and main driving force of any changes. Modern Russian society does not identify a strong and effective state with a totalitarian one. I'll just parenthesize here. Just because this state's strong doesn't mean it's communist.
Right.
Right. He goes on, we have learned to value the benefits of democracy, a law-based state, personal and political freedom. At the same time, and here he's looking back on the Yeltsin years, people are alarmed by the obvious weakening of state power. Society desires a restoration of the guiding and regulating role of the state to the necessary degree proceeding from the traditions and present state of this country.
Now, when he says traditions and he's looking at this strong state, a state that can preserve order, is he going all the way back to the czars and, you know, how long is this historical memory?
Well, there? That's an interesting question. I personally think it's a very venerable political memory. He has on more than one occasion when asked who does he admire out of the Russian past, he admires Catherine the Great, who first took up a lot of what Peter the Great had by her own telling. If we were doing Catherine the Great, I'd go into much more detail on this. But what many people see Catherine as having done is introduce some system, some clarity, some consistency to a bunch of initiatives that Peter first tried to implement. That Catherine is the first successful articulator of a certain vision of state power and its use and its interaction with society. So that's one of his heroes. The other is a man named Pyotr Arkadyevich Stolypin, who was a prime minister of Russia from the spring of 1906 until his assassination in September 1911. And I think what Putin likes about Stolypin comes to power in the midst of the reconstitution of the autocratic order following the twin shocks of military defeat in a war with Japan, 1904-1905, and growing out of that, a huge revolution that almost overthrew the autocracy. In retrospect, an overlooked revolution, given all the attention we paid in 1917.
1905 revolution.
The revolution 1905. Stolypin takes over, and he does a series of things. First is he institutes a policy of strict reprisals against any terror, right? He has his own war on terror to the extent that revolutionaries soon start referring to boxcars used to deport them to Siberia as Stolypin Pullmans, right? The old Russian.
Yeah.
And the hangman's noose becomes Stolypin necktie. But he imposes martial law in great many districts, has drumhead courts, and reestablishes what he would consider order. Secondly, recognizing that one of the big problems is what they call the agrarian question, overpopulation, what he would consider an antiquated mode of land use, he institutes a land reform to create a sector of private freeholding peasants who would sort of self-select out of the communal land tenure institutions that dominated most of rural Russia at the time. Thirdly, he tried to create support within society by reaching out to rural nobles who'd become disaffected for a variety of reasons, but also by building an alliance within the State Duma, this electoral, legislative, semi-legislative body that Nicholas II is forced to grant in 1905-1906. And Stolypin seems to be enjoying some success at this. However, Stolypin never loses the view. If you put these words in old Russian script and tweak them a little bit, Stolypin would probably agree with them. And what binds them all together is this idea that in a country as big as Russia, as Catherine would say, you need a very strong centralized state power to hold everything together, but also, as Putin said, to maintain order. Because order is the only condition in which people can pursue their daily bread, right? And because there are so many conflicting interests at work in a marketplace or in society, you need somebody there to mediate among these interests. And then finally, because Russia isn't what it ought to be, whether you call Russia backward or Eastern or whatever, all three of these people have some sense that Russia has to get somewhere, right? That Russia has to be rebuilt, or that you need a state that's directed by professionals who understand that statecraft is an art and that it has certain demands and it requires a certain level of professional skill and a certain selflessness. You're standing above society. Those of your listeners who've read Hobbes's Leviathan will remember, or the way I remember it is an old drawing for My Fair Lady that showed George Bernard Shaw as a marionetteer with Eliza and Higgins and that being the puppets. That in this vision, only those who are at the highest echelons of state power have the historical vision, the professional skill, the strategic orientation, and the levers with which to mobilize society for the achievement of goals that will suit everybody. For regular citizens, prosperity, but also membership in a great power, right? Because Putin's going to make Russia great again, and that's one of Stolypin's slogans, we need a great Russia. But prosperity that the market brings, all working towards sustaining this situation, supporting the government, right? That in this sense, everybody is working for the same goal under the tutelage of the state. And if you're going for something else, you're being selfish, you're being elitist, you're only thinking of your own personal gain. And that's why you can't allow the commercial sector to get into the state, because they're only worried about their selfish profits.
And how do we square that, I almost call it a utopian vision, with the Moscow's recent acquisition as the number one city for billionaires?
Oh, that's fine. If you're get all the money you want, to quote an old Soviet leader, enrich yourself.
In some selfless way?
Nope. Just don't get into politics. There is a man who's spending most of his late young manhood and edging into middle agehood in a jail in, I think it's Omsk, a guy named Mikhail Kharkovsky, who tried to take on Putin, tried to use his accumulated wealth to fund opposition party against Putin, and they came down on him like a ton of bricks. Other people, Boris Berezovsky, left the country. Like, this is the story of the oligarchs. Putin and the leadership don't seem to mind them making money, but don't be visibly corrupt and do not be using this money against us. You guys work in the commercial sector. We are men of state. The state's matter is our affair. If you want to, have your garage full of Bugatti Royale collector cars or whatever, more power to you. But do not poach on our turf.
What does the West need to know about Russia right now? That in a moment when we continue with University of the Year. We all must think anew about Russia, but this process will prove harder for some of us than for others. That's from a recent column in the New York Times called Coming to Grips with Russia's New Nerve. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is David MacDonald. We're talking about contemporary Russian politics. Well, if we all must think anew about Russia, we have to think about it in a new way, and we're entering into a presidential election, a lot of rhetoric getting tossed around. What is it that we need to think about Russia in a new way?
Well, I think there are several things. I think first, and the biggest problem is escaping, and I read that column too, and he points it out, James Traub, I think his name is, points out in a certain way. I think we've all, even I have, experienced some sort of Cold War reflex. This is Russia being Russia. This Soviet Norm started off by asking, is the Soviet Union being regathered? I don't think the Soviet Union is being regathered. I don't think that the Russian Federation is really interested in governing a lot of these places, because it wasn't much fun when the Soviet Union existed. You'd have to, if you were from Moscow, you'd have to go out and sit in some what you considered impossibly provincial center. I do think there is solicitude for Russian speakers living in places like Estonia, Georgia, Kazakhstan, or that. But the big thing is both campaigns, say in the presidential elections, and many British politicians, the Europeans have been a bit more subtle or nuanced in their response. We talk about return to totalitarianism, return to we've got to deal with Russia in a certain way. There's only one language. Or like Miliband said, I quoted him earlier, that the idea of spheres of interest is old and outmoded. Well, the fact is, I think we all have to accept that this is a world in which Russia has reemerged for the time being. That might disappear with oil fluctuations. I don't think so, but it's a possibility. And the other thing you'll hear is Russia is weak. The Economist, for instance, a couple other publications have talked about Russian weakness. Well, Russia isn't weak in that part of the world. And depending on how you're measuring or what you're measuring, Russia's weakness is something we can tell ourselves. Oh, this is all smoke and mirrors, or more accurately, oil and weak dollars. So that means we cannot lapse into this old Manichaean way of looking at our relationship with Russia, that every point of tangency is a point of necessary confrontation or rivalry. There are all sorts of areas where the West and Russia have to get along. The management, the ongoing management of the Iran situation. And that I would expect to see become more complicated depending on relations between the U.S. and Russia. The Middle East, Syria, on whom any viable Middle East settlement depends, they have very good relations with Russia. Iraq might in a future Iraq, right, because of the of oil processing technology and the ability to buy assets that the Russians have. China, North Korea, the war on terrorism, right? That I believe that Russian leaders are sincere when they express interest in cooperating on any and all of these. And I don't know if we can afford to take a stance that says we are going to discontinue relations with you until you smarten up vis-a-vis Georgia, right?
That, which is the current thinking.
Which seems to be – and there's a hard and soft variant depending whether you're talking to the McCain campaign, the Obama campaign, or the outgoing incumbents in the White House. I also think that the age of – and I might be wrong on this, but I don't think I am – the age of a unilateral or a unipotent American hegemony are over. Right, that somebody, I think her name's Sarah Mendelson, a specialist on Soviet, there, that's my slip into the old reflexes in Russian politics. She talked about this being the end of the post-Soviet era. And it's interesting, and it's worth remembering, in a perverse way, apparently a stable global order needs Russia, that the Soviet Union collapses. We've had 18 years of some geopolitical turmoil. And now we're just as was the case in the interwar period after the Great War, when the Romanov dynasty collapses and the Habsburgs, and you get all this turmoil that really isn't resolved until 1955 or until 1989, depending on how you look at it. Now, I think there are certain – I think there are things that the Russians accept and have to accept. The reconfiguration of Europe with the EU and NATO, the extension of NATO to Russia's borders. I think they understand that's a fait accompli. There's no one doing that. I think relations with places like Ukraine and Georgia, I think that that is going to be very complicated. And
but Russia dominated.
I think
almost inevitably, wouldn't it be, just because of geography?
Well, I think Russia would like to, but I think that anything like the placement of, for instance, an attachment to NATO without either including Russia and NATO or some other SOP will complicate things vastly for them. And that poses a test for the American population as well, because we heard a great deal about appeasement and Sudetenland and all the rest of it during the Georgia campaign. And I would be – you know, Americans are going to have to ask themselves, if the world looks like they think it looks, are they willing to send their sons and daughters to fight for Georgia? or Ukraine. So those parts of the relationship demand careful reflection and handling. And I think we have to take Russia seriously on its own terms. The other thing we do is we think subjunctively about Russia. Russia should be this. Russia should do that. Russians seem to be quite satisfied doing things like they do, just like their predecessors did. The Chinese, we don't say this about, right?
Well, we do in terms of human rights, but
of course they don't buy it for a second.
No, and while we're taking part in the Olympics and all the rest of it, and even while they're going after confiscating religious literature from people in the country, while Tibet's going on, we've always had a much more pragmatic orientation towards China than we have towards Russia.
Well, then let me ask you, since you read the newspapers in Russian as well as our own here, what are you seeing in terms of their perspective on themselves and on us that you think would help us get a different perspective than we do right now?
One thing that has shown up in English as well, this is we're back. We're back. And as I said earlier, you can't lecture us like children. They will hammer much more insistently than gets played in the Western press. This was a provocation. The Georgians started it. It's funny, they don't want to be lectured as children, but I recognize that line of argumentation from many years of my own childhood. The Georgians started it. But most of all, don't act like we need you. Don't act like we're your dependent. If you want to start another Cold War, we can get along just fine. And they're thinking of China. They're thinking of the Koreas. They're thinking of India, with whom they have very strong relations. That there's nothing necessary anymore about a relationship with NATO and the West. That they've got other places they can turn to. And that's the biggest challenge we face related to the decline of unipolarity or the end of the post-Soviet era is it's going to be interesting to see how many people, how many states can afford to be ideologically oriented in their politics, given the variety of states that there are out there, China, India, Pakistan, whatever is going to be happening there. And that's a very concerning part of the world. Iran isn't going away. Israel isn't going away. The EU, that's not just types of states, types of power, petro power, control over credit and debt instruments, environmental power, control over fresh water. There's all sorts of other levers that are emerging. And we have to be looking at Russia and at one another in all these contexts in a way we can't afford to go back to the Cold War way of thinking.
Well, the big difference, I mean, if there is one overarching difference, I hope, between now and the Cold War, it's the nuclear card is not being talked about seriously. I mean, there are murky references to it when we talk about putting shields in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
But things don't look nearly as monolithic east-west, our nukes, your nukes, as they did in 1965.
Even 62.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think that's right now. Plus, which again, in those days, if you discounted France and Great Britain and maybe China, the nuclear showdown was a bilateral thing, whereas now, in a funny way, one might argue that the fact that India, Pakistan, Israel in an ill-kept secret, then these other powers have the bomb, it seems so far this proliferation might even continue mutual assured destruction, except multilaterally rather than bilaterally. But that's an interesting element because that's Russia's ticket to membership at the grown-up table in great power politics, where it was through the 90s. And now they feel – one reason you might not be hearing that is because they feel they've got other tickets they can use now.
So a sort of personal question for you. If instead of being the chair of the history department, you were actually an advisor to the president, sort of a Rasputin behind-the-scenes person, and you could advise
– outgoing or incoming.
Sort of a generic president, American president. And you saw the next few years coming up in Russia. What kinds of things would you be advising in terms of foreign policy?
I would be advising her or him to be looking at the relationship with NATO and to have hard decisions about what they were willing to commit to in terms of membership, especially for Georgia and Ukraine. I would be telling the president that you have to find some way of showing proper respect for areas of Russian interest. And when you say we have interests here, because we do. We talk about our interests. What is it makes them our interests? If it's just the cause of freedom or democracy or the rest of it, you've got to take into account what's that looking like to Moscow, that you can't act outraged when Moscow reacts a certain way. What if – well, and this might be a possibility – if Russian troops start doing war games with Cuba? They're talking about war games with Venezuela. How are we going to react? But we've got to find a way to change the tone of the discussion, where it's possible to disagree. It's possible to disagree over big things. But the biggest thing is, what are we able to control? And right now, with troops in Iraq, the ongoing war in Afghanistan, the other commitments we have, are we really prepared and are we really able to intervene in the way that some people would suggest? And if we aren't, then what's our triage of other measures? Is there a way to support democracy and democratic development in Georgia without it being threatening to Russia, especially if Georgian democracy is built on trying to mobilize national hostility to Russia? Right, that this is just a period where we've got to be very careful and take Russia seriously, not as a child, but as a returned power.
Always illuminating, our guest, David MacDonald, and a font of fascinating facts about Russia today, and not just Russia, but of course all those other pieces of the former Soviet state. Thanks for being with us again.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Come back and fill us in about Catherine the Great sometime. That sounds very intriguing too. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.